First of all, derive and talk about the Cartan formalism. So the first bit of it's going to be quite formal or mathematical, where we're going to derive Cartan's first structural equation. And I'm going to at least state what the second structural equation is. Then we're going to use those to calculate the Riemann tensor for a particular metric. So you may have actually seen this in the introductory general relativity course in the context of when you found the Schwarzschild solution. So I'm guessing you kind of actually went through for a particular metric. In our case, we're going to have slightly more general metric, but it's simply as an illustration of how the Cartan formalism actually works, and hopefully to, although I'll be writing everything down in absolutely full detail, to try and persuade that this is actually quite an elegant way of doing curvature computations, and it's, at least for simpler metrics, reasonably straightforward metrics, particularly when you go to higher dimensions, actually quicker than typing it in to a notebook. So let me just start off with a definition. So, as I said, this is a formalism that uses exterior differentiation and forms. So I want to construct some one forms out of the connection. Now, of course, these are not purely geometrical objects because they're constructed from the connection coefficients, which are not tensorial. But nonetheless, they are one forms because we put in a basis vector omega b. Now, this is sometimes, you'll see this is also called the spin connection, because a lot of this formalism is used in supergravity with some slight differences in notation. So in supergravity, you'll often sort of see both the vector and the covector bases being denoted as E, because you're usually working in an orthonormal basis. And in that case, the components of the covector, the covector bases are usually sort of quite straightforwardly related to the components of the vector bases. And the spin connection may be written as omega. So I'm simply using theta here to kind of differentiate the fact I wanted to have a distinction between the vector basis, the covector basis, the dual basis, and then I obviously want a different symbol for my one forms, my connection one forms. And of course, this is also a general connection one form. I am not, as yet, assuming that these are orthonormal bases, because at the moment, I haven't assumed that we have a metric. I've just assumed we've got a connection. And I'm going to talk about computing that connection. So, although these one forms are true for a general connection, I'm just going to note that for our metric connection, or for a metric connection, the exterior derivative of the components of the metric are equal to the symmetric part of our connection one forms. So let me just prove that or demonstrate that. And once again, you'll be seeing the fact that we're not using abstract index notation. G, A, B are the components of the metric with respect to the basis, E. So they're scalars. So D of G is the same as grad of G. And grad is, what a GAB? Well, we take, here's that comma again, we take the contraction of G, which is a second rank covariant tensor with two basis vectors. That's how we define components. We take basis vectors and contract our object with them. So here, these are our components of GAB. And so this, our covariant derivative, it's a metric connection. So when we pull inside the contraction, it doesn't see the metric because grad G is zero. So it only sees these two objects, grad EA and grad EB. So we know, of course, what the covariant derivative of our basis is. This is where we get our connection coefficients. So this gives us a gamma piece. But now if I look at what I've got here, this is just GCB. And this piece, you see I've got gamma, where is it? Gamma with the covector basis. And notice, should have said, notice that you're contracting on the first index here, the differentiating index. So I'm being careful here because I'm not assuming that we're torsion-free yet, just metric connection. So this is our connection one form. And so the effect of these metric components here are simply to pull down that C index. And it gives us the symmetric part of the connection one forms. So this is why it's often very useful to go into an orthonormal basis, because in an orthonormal basis, the components of G are either plus or minus 1 or 0. So D of G is 0, which tells us that the connection one forms are antisymmetric. So that obviously means that if something's anti-symmetric, it has fewer independent components, so there's less to compute. Right, so let's derive Cartan's first structural equation, which tells us how to compute these connection one forms by process of exterior differentiation. So let's consider this particular wedge product, the product of the connection one forms with the covector basis. So we know that this is just by replacing what the connection one forms are, we see that this is given in terms of the connection coefficients contracted with omega b cross omega c. But of course, this omega b cross omega c is, of course, antisymmetric in b and c. Therefore, this is taking, if you like, it's the same as we can replace this with the anti-symmetrized part of our connection. But we know that the anti-symmetric part of the connection is essentially the torsion up to these structure constants. So I can replace my connection coefficients with the torsion tensor and the structure constants. So if I now, let me just take this first piece where I'm defining T is a half TABC omega B cross omega C is the torsion 2 form. So I'm simply sort of making that look a bit neater. And I've now replaced the structure constants with an expression that defines them. So again, that's telling you about the Lie bracket of the basis vectors. So here, I'm now going to, if you remember, I commented when I wrote down a relationship between the Lie bracket and D, it had something of this form, okay? So I'll just write it down now with so that's replacing that, I think I wrote it down in terms of omega u and v, and I'm simply now writing in the basis elements using that relationship that I wrote down. But of course, omega aec is delta ac, which is just a set of constants. So that's zero, and similarly, that term is zero. So what I can now do is I can replace this contraction with the derivative of the basis one form, the basis covectors. So if I pull that together and rearrange it, I can express my torsion 2 form as this theta AC cross omega C minus this term here, but this term here minus that term is just plus the d omega term. And then this here, this is taking a scalar product, but then I'm sort of reforming, making it back into a 2 form by taking this. So this scalar product gives me the BC components of D omega A. I then contract it with omega B cross omega C, lifts it back to a 2 form. So in fact, this is simply D omega A. So that is Cartan's first structural equation. And since we said we wanted a metric connection, which was torsion-free, that means, first of all, that this combination here has to vanish for a torsion-free connection. And for a metric connection, if I'm shrewd and I choose an orthonormal basis of one forms, then I have an anti-symmetric anti-symmetric spin connection, which means that I have fewer components of theta to compute. So in four dimensions, there's only six possibilities for theta. And I can get those by just taking d of omega, and there's only four of those. So I do four exterior differentiations, a little bit of picking pieces out, and then I've got my connection. So it's not only a more economical way of computing connections, it usually turns out to be a bit easier because the exterior differentiation is often quite straightforward. So Cartan's second equation tells us how to compute curvature, but before I write it down, I just want to just briefly review curvature. So rather like when you're in field theory and you're asking what is the what's the field strength of a particular gauge potential, that's the same as essentially it's like a curvature of a gauge connection. There you take a commutator of gauge covariant derivatives acting on the field. So you typically get that F is dA plus A wedge A for a gauge field. In this case, we're going to do more or less the same thing. And it just might be written down in a slightly different way from what you've already seen in the introductory course, because, of course, I want to define this for such that it's true whether or not you've got a metric connection, whether or not you've got torsion. So this is how we define the curvature of a connection. We take a commutator of covariant derivatives, and then we have to add a little bookkeeping term, grad uv, because if u and v don't commute, if they have a non-vanishing Lie bracket, then there's a sort of an extra piece in this commutator, which is not geometric, or at least it's not actually telling you about curvature. So we always have to have that bookkeeping piece here. So that might be a little different from what you saw before.
Is delta here torsion free?
It doesn't matter. So this is simply, given a connection, whatever it may be, this is the curvature of the connection. When you have the torsion free and all these additional properties, what that usually translates into is additional symmetries in the Riemann tensor, or in this R tensor here. So this Riemann tensor here is a map takes three vectors at a point and gives you another vector at a point. So in this case, we're defining it, you can think of it as a multilinear map. So if I ask what is it in components, again, it's going to be something close to what you've seen, but a little bit different. Stare at my page here because the ordering of indices actually matters here. There we go. So the first four terms should be familiar because they're there whether or not you've got, you know, coordinate basis or whatever. The final term is there to tell you about the structure constant. So if you don't have a coordinate basis, if you have structure constants, then there'll be extra terms in your connection which need to be subtracted off. So physically, as we know, curvature tells us about tidal forces. So it's the non-trivial part of the geometry. It's the bit that is, you know, that's different about gravity from pure acceleration. So Cartan's second equation relates the curvature to the connection, again, using exterior differentiation. So we need to... Oh, dear. No, I've probably just got to fix it again. Is this working?
Yes.
Right, so the curvature 2 form is defined. We know the last two indices on the Riemann tensor are antisymmetric, so the components of the Riemann tensor. And you see that from the definition here. And these are the sort of three and four indices if we were finding components. And so here there's a very clear antisymmetry in U and V as an operator acting on the W. And so we know that there's sort of this Riemann, the components of the Riemann tensor are intrinsically two-form-like on the last two indices. So it's very natural to construct a two-form out of the Riemann tensor. And so Cartan's second equation gives the curvature 2 form in terms of the connection. So the thing to kind of keep in mind here is that the, you know, your curvature of your gauge curvature is the commutator of the gauge covariant derivative, if you remember, acting on a field. And it sort of looks like dA plus A wedge A, roughly. So I'm only doing this schematically. But you can see that there's sort of at least an analogy between the two different situations. You've got d theta plus theta wedge theta. So that's what your curvature looks like. And of course, it's sort of a little less intimidating than this expression here. Okay. So I want to demonstrate this, or the use of these equations, with an example. So this is what the handout is about. The reason for producing the handout is simply that there's a lot of algebra that I'm going to go through on the board. And, you know, rather than have you worrying about getting it all down, then you've got this in front of you so you can kind of annotate it and instead focus on seeing how watching me do the calculation, if you like, because, you know, that's perhaps more valuable, because then you can see, you know, what are the steps? What are you thinking about? How would I do it if I had to sit down and do it? So there are bits I'm not going to go through on the handout. We made this handout a few years back. And what it does, what it begins by doing, is trying to show how you reduce a metric down to a simpler form. So the, here it's describing the use of the killing vectors for, with SO3 symmetry. So it's showing how that translates into a considerable simplifications of the number of degrees of freedom in the metric. So the first bit, as I say, is I'm not going to go through, but we thought we'd just leave it there because, you know, you might want to take a look and just see how these things work. So my example, specifically, is going to be a 4D spherically symmetric metric. Now, I'm going to write it down in a very general gauge for the moment. So this d omega 2 squared, hopefully you've seen it, that notation before, it's shorthand for the metric on a unit 2 sphere, or n sphere, whatever. So I say I've written it down in a general gauge. That means that I could actually, there's a bit of a redundancy here. I could choose b equals 1. I could choose my radial coordinate to set b to 1. I could choose it to set b to 1 over a. Or I could choose it such that the area of two spheres is equal to 4 pi r squared. So there's various different choices that, of gauge that one could do. I'm just going to stick with these general functions simply because I want to, or I will want later, to kind of draw on patterns where, you know, patterns with calculations, patterns with curvatures. So the first step in the calculation So we want to calculate the connection. In order to calculate the connection, we need to find an orthonormal basis and then find its exterior derivative. So it's fairly clear from the way I've written it that my orthonormal basis is this. So if I take those one forms, then my distance is simply eta ab times omega a omega b. So that's what my metric looks like. And so I can differentiate those. Well, d of omega t, by the way, I'm putting hats on the on these indices to just remind, this is like a reminder that this is an orthonormal basis, because typically when you see a t-index, it often means a coordinate index. So this is kind of emphasizing that this is just a little different index. So d of omega t is d of a of r dt. I'll go through this one in a lot of detail and then skip, be a bit more brief with the others. So d dt is 0, d squared is 0, so we don't see anything when we hit dt. So this is simply dA wedge dt, which is A primed dr wedge dt, which is A primed over AB. And I'm going to, for reasons which will become apparent, just swap the ordering of these two. I'm now rewriting it back in the orthonormal basis. So I started off by writing out explicitly what my orthonormal basis was in terms of the coordinate basis. I calculate my derivative. I re-express it back in terms of the orthonormal basis. That is d of omega t. So exactly analogously, d of omega r is actually 0 because b depends on r. And so the whole thing, omega r, is just a function of r. So if I take d, I either get d squared of r or dr wedge dr, which is 0. And then for the remaining ones, d of omega theta is in direct analogy to d of omega t. You get the same expression. And finally, d of omega phi. So here I've got c prime sine theta dr cross d phi plus c cos theta d theta cross d phi, which is c primed over cb omega phi cross dr cross omega r, minus cot theta over c omega phi cross omega theta. So it's simply taking a derivative in a really obvious sense, and now I've done all the differentiation that I need to do in order to identify what my connection is. So the second step is to use Cartan 1, to identify theta. So it's a metric torsion-free connection. So d of omega A is minus theta AB cross omega B. So once again, we'll just be a bit slower about the time component here. So d of omega t hat, which is minus A primed on AB omega t cross omega r, should be equal to minus theta TA cross omega A. So here you can see that the only thing that we've got here is a T and an R. We know that the connection forms are anti-symmetric, so there's no theta TT piece. So therefore, the only non-zero piece will be a theta TR piece. So that was why I swapped the ordering here. And so this should be minus theta T hat R hat cross omega R hat. So that means my theta TR is going to be this thing. Okay? And so by exactly the same process, I can read off theta hat r hat. So those are, look, you know, the pattern is there, the pattern's exactly the same. And so the only thing that's missing, if I look there and I think about the phi piece, is when I look at d omega phi, I've also got a piece involving omega theta and omega phi. And so the only other non-zero piece I can read off as theta phi theta, which is cot theta over c omega phi. So that's now my connection, and that's all the components of the connection in this coded format in terms of the connection one forms. So I've finished calculating the connection coefficients for this metric. So my third step is to compute the curvature, well, third, almost final step. So once again, there are potentially six independent components, and I shouldn't just say, oh, well, hang on, T theta component of the connection one form vanishes, so I don't bother calculating R. I've got to actually go and check each in turn. So let me just do that. step by step. If I look at the TR components, if I have a T, obviously the first bit is d theta TR, but if I have a T here, the only non-zero component here is R, which means this C is an R, but B is already R, so that's zero. So all I have here is just d of theta TR, and theta TR there is just A primed on AB omega T. So that's d of A primed on B dt. So I'm re-expressing things back in terms of the original coordinate basis. So here, that's A primed on B primed dr cross dt, which is, I write that out in detail. So once again, I go back into expressing it in terms of the orthonormal basis. So now let me look at other components of the curvature 2 form. RT theta, there's no theta, T theta, because there's no spin connection components with T and theta, but I can get a cross term if I think about it. So here I've got to sum over indices, and so it's fairly clear the only non-zero connection one form component here is TR, but that also partners me up with a theta R theta. Now, this theta R theta term is minus theta R hat theta hat, because I'm in pulling an index down, this is an orthonormal basis, so the metric coefficients are either plus one or minus one, and in my conventions, the spatial indices have a minus one, so that's equal to minus theta R theta, which is plus theta theta hat R hat, which is minus theta theta hat R hat. So, and we know what this is, because this was what we actually calculated. I didn't bother, when I calculated the spin connection, I didn't bother writing down every single non-zero component. I only wrote down the linearly independent ones. So here, we've got theta TR, which is A primed on AB. We've got a theta theta R, which is a C primed on CB. And so what I get is a non-zero curvature piece. And by exactly the same argument, we get exactly the same sort of a piece or appearance for the phi angle. So I'm now halfway through calculating my curvature. So we're on a roll, so let's keep going. Let's do the theta term. So here, you can sort of see, this is where I'm saying patterns. This is why it's always so useful to do calculations yourself. You actually start to begin to really appreciate patterns. So the theta, calculating this theta component of the curvature 2 form, you see that the way the theta component looks with R is almost exactly the same as T. So again, by analogy, we're going to get 1 over b squared, c double primed on c, so you can check it yourself, but you can, it's again the same sort of pattern, and the only time we have to do a little bit of thought here now is in the phi piece, because here there's actually both bits are contributing in the Cartan second equation. There's both D of the connection one form as well as a theta wedge theta piece. So if I now write down exactly what these are, theta phi r, that's over there. No, where is it? Okay, so I simply write down what those substitute in, what the connection one forms are, and I do the differentiation here. So my first term is going to be similar to this. So that's the first piece of differentiation. Now the second piece of differentiation is where this d hits sine theta, and then I have c primed over b cos theta d theta cross d phi. But now if I look at the second term, if I express omega phi and omega theta in terms of the coordinate basis, each of these contributes a c, and so I end up with c primed over b, and then there's a sine theta hidden in here, so I end up with a cos theta. So the prefactor is the same in each case, but here I've got a theta cross phi, and here I've got a phi cross theta. So those two terms cancel, and I'm left with exactly the same sort of piece as with the theta coordinate. And then finally, r phi theta again looks very similar. It has two pieces in it. So r phi theta here, we've got d of cos theta d phi, which is at least a simple differentiation. And then the second term is going to be c prime squared over c squared b squared omega phi cross omega theta with a minus sign. So pulling that together, so what I end up with is just 1 over c squared minus c prime squared over c squared b squared. So that's now finished the calculation part of it. I've done all the exterior differentiation. That's it. Those are all the non-zero components of the curvature 2 form. And so hidden inside that those six expressions are my Riemann components. So, of course, the final step is to extract these Riemann components. And here we use that R, our curvature 2 form, is obtained, you know, is the Riemann components together with two basis vectors. So in each case, if you look here, I've got omega r cross omega t. Here's omega c cross omega d. So you can see that that's telling me that if I put if I look at the TR Riemann term, the only non-zero pieces have a T and an R at the end. So you read off, you simply go through reading off these non-zero components. So here, from this one, I've got T hat R hat, and then I've got R hat T hat, so I just copy down that expression. Then I have to do T theta. So I'm halfway through extracting these. Then theta r, r theta. And finally, right, so that's the end of, or at least that's the end of the calculation as far as finding the Riemann tensor is concerned. So obviously there's, you know, well, how many boards does that cover? One, two and a half. In my opinion, that's somewhat easier than actually going through and calculating the gammas in a coordinate basis and then calculating all those Riemann coefficients. Because typically, well, I don't know about you, but typically I find if I've got a lot of indices, like the, you know, an expression with lots going on, like this one here, where you're summing over these indices here, it's often quite easy to forget a coordinate while you're doing that and to make a mistake. It's a little harder to, I mean, it doesn't mean you can't make mistakes. It's just a little harder to make mistakes using this method. So it is a little bit more reliable, and it is a lot quicker once you get used to it. I think it's the getting used to it that takes a bit of time. So let's just now use what we've calculated to actually try and extract something familiar. So here, notice that, remember, this is an... This is an orthonormal basis, and usually we deal with coordinate bases. And so for convenience, I'm just going to sort of lift some of these indices up, and I'm going to find my Ricci tensor. So RTT is going to be the same as RT hat T hat, because we've got a very simple basis here. So if I want to find RT hat T hat, I've got to look at this, summing up these three Riemann components. And each of them actually come with, well, this one's the same sign, because I've got to sum over first and third indices. So I have to lift up this R index. That gives me one minus sign. And then I've got to swap the first two indices, which gives me a second one. Then I've got to add up these two. I've got to raise the angular indices there. So I get a plus sign. And so that's my RTT. R theta theta. Now for the R theta theta, I've got to get one of these pieces here from the component, and then finally, I've got to add in this piece here. One minute. Let's make sure of the sign here. Got one. Oh, that should be plus. Yeah. Okay, and that is the same as R phi phi, as it should be for spherical symmetry. And then the final Ricci component is the RR component, which is just these derivatives here. Okay, so I've calculated my Ricci tensor, and now I could go ahead and solve the Einstein equations to sort of find out what the spherically symmetric solutions are. So before I do that, I just want to discuss gauge a little bit. I mentioned that I'd been very general. I mean, I'd sort of made work for myself in a way by not simplifying the metric as far as I could. Now, the reason for this is that whereas in standard general relativity, a sort of energy condition will tell you that the area of spheres around a spherically symmetric gravitating object always increases, so you might as well choose that to be 4 pi r squared. That's not true in some modifications of gravity. So sometimes you don't want to restrict yourself to writing 4 pi r squared, because if you do, you might come to the conclusion that your system is singular, or it might look like it's singular, whereas in reality, all that's happening is the spheres are now getting bigger as you move in rather than moving out. Getting bigger as you move out. So, for a choice of gauge, I'm just going to mention sort of three possibilities, which I mentioned at the beginning. B equals 1, that tells you that dr is proper radial distance. So your radial coordinate really is the distance out from the center or from some fiducial point. You can also choose B as A inverse. And this is a sort of Schwarzschild type of choice. And of course, if we're dealing with Einstein gravity, we'd then find that areas of spheres were 4 pi r squared. But again, as I said, in some other, for example, if you look at a sort of pseudo-stringy four-dimensional gravity, you find that you can take B as 1 over A, but C is definitely not R. And then the one that's most common is the area gauge, C equals R. So that's saying the area of two spheres is 4 pi r squared. So if we choose that, then that means that all these C double prime terms are going to disappear, because C is just R, and what we're left with is sort of a somewhat simpler set of equations. So if I look now at GTT, if I now put in C as R, then I've only got my GTT as just one function, it's B. So I get 1 over R squared minus, I can rewrite my GTT as 1 over R squared minus a total derivative. And this, by Einstein's equations, should be 8 pi g t naught naught. So in solving my spherically symmetric space-time, I can now write it in a very intuitive way. I've got, I've now integrated up to get my exact B metric function, and I've rewritten it here. I get 1, that's great, because I want to be asymptotically flat. It should go to 1 at infinity. I've got 1 over R, and now if I look at what's inside my integral, now, again, you've got to be a little careful about interpretation. But here we've got T naught naught, which is like an energy density. And then I've got 4 pi R squared dr. And that's simply telling me about the volume between a sphere of radius R and the sphere that's just a little bit bigger. Okay? So this whole thing here, this whole bit, looks like sort of delta M between sort of R and R plus dr. So this whole thing can be interpreted as M of R. So we're not doing a vacuum solution here. We're actually looking at any solution, okay? So if, for example, what you'll have already seen, let me just do two quick examples. Vacuum. So in vacuum, outside, this tells us that 1 over b squared is going to be 1 minus 2gm on R, where m is just some constant. This will be the general solution. Could be 0, might not be. And then if I look at, now let me see. So if I look at my radial Einstein equation, you can sort of see that this tells you that a squared is proportional to 1 minus 2gm on r. So on the left-hand side, you've got a squared, sort of r's cancel. Left-hand side is a squared primed on a squared. Move that to the right-hand side, it's 1 minus 2gm on r primed over 1 minus 2gm on r. So that tells you a squared is essentially 1 over b squared. And of course, that is the Schwarzschild solution. And finally, just to very quickly outline what happens with a cosmological constant. Well, with a cosmological constant, you still have a squared equals 1 over b squared outside any source. But now if I look at integrating my b squared here, remember b squared is 1 minus 2g on r. And so here, I replace my 8 pi g sorry, I replace 8 pi g t naught naught by lambda, and so I'm simply integrating r squared dr, okay? So I get 1 minus 2 gm on r, which is my integration constant, the general term. And then here I get an r cubed over 3, and so I have a minus lambda over 3 r squared. So here, because we haven't kind of gone through in our computation of Riemann by trying to simplify things using the fact we're looking for a vacuum solution, because we've kept it in terms of the Einstein tensor and energy momentum, we can now start to pick off solutions in a wider range of cases. So this gives you the Newtonian potential for a black hole in a cosmological constant space-time. And I've overrun, so I'll stop there.